Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Mexico's take on U.S. drug consumption. Have you ever heard it? Nigeria and the U.N. in the crosshairs of terrorism. A Brazilian take on U.S. partisan gridlock. Have you ever heard that? Good morning, everyone. As you know, the United Nations General Assembly is meeting this week here in New York. And as you no doubt have been hearing, the main topic of conversation by far is the Palestinians' bid for recognition as a state. And everyone is talking about yesterday's speech by President Obama urging the Palestinians not to go through with it. We aired some of that speech live on this show yesterday as it was happening, and we will talk more in depth about the Palestinian state question tomorrow. But today we begin by remembering that there are more than 100 other countries at this year's UN, all with something to say, all of whose leaders get a chance to speak in front of the assembly. So let's begin today by listening to excerpts from three other speeches from yesterday, not our president's, speeches that weren't given by someone named Barack Obama, but that relate to our concerns nonetheless here in the U.S. of A. We will focus on three countries, Mexico, Nigeria, and Brazil. And we start with Mexican President Felipe Calderon. Here's about 2 minutes of his speech from yesterday's UN General Assembly, featuring, by the way, the riveting vocal work of a UN translator. And the point here is mostly that if the U.S. likes to blame Mexico for the availability of drugs in this country, you will hear President Calderon blame right back.
Organized crime is strengthened because of the huge profits coming from the sale of illegal drugs throughout the world. Alas, the demand for drugs continues to grow in such markets. And we have to say this while there are still consumers of drugs who are willing to pay tens of thousands of millions of dollars for their addictions, this source of funding of criminal activity will be the main source of it. Mexico is playing its part. It is combating crime in all its forms, most energetically. However, now more than ever, consumer countries where drugs are consumed must take effective action radically to cut demand. I will be told that this is not possible, that the demand for drugs continues to rise, as is indeed the case here in the United States, where nearly 30% of young people consume drugs, or elsewhere in the world. And what is the solution? Quite honestly, I would say, if you cannot cut the demand for drugs, or if you don't want to, or if you have become resigned to this consumption increasing, consumer countries are morally obliged to reduce the vast economic profits obtained by criminals from this black market.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon, in your left channel, if you happen to be listening in stereo, UN translator in your right channel, and a scolding for the U.S. So let's talk about this with Ken Ellingwood, correspondent in the Mexico Bureau for the Los Angeles Times. Ken, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Why this speech? Why at the U.N.?
Well, Calderon has felt in a difficult position here. He's been under pressure for Mexico has been for years to take some kind of action against the drug cartels, which move drugs from South America and in some cases Mexico north to the United States. He launched a big offensive against drug cartels after taking office in late night 2006, sending the military out into the streets. And since that time, Mexico has been just awash in violence. We're looking at a death toll now of over 40,000 dead since that time. And so he's under a lot of political pressure at home to rein in the violence and explain his strategy. And he has consistently pointed the finger north when it's appropriate, and it is appropriate in most of these cases, because, as he points out, the drugs are destined for a hungry U.S. market, which pays billions, as he just said, tens of billions of dollars in consumption. And so he's talking to the world, but he's also talking to the United States in particular, and he's also talking to his constituents back home who want to hear him scold the United States from time to time.
I don't know if we happen to have any Mexican nationals or Mexican Americans listening right now who want to call up and react to President Calderon's speech. We're just going to do this for like 5 minutes if you want to call in right away. And then we have two more speech excerpts to go on to from the presidents of Nigeria and Brazil. You think we're getting scolded by Calderon? Wait till you hear the scolding that we get on our political gridlock and economic leadership from Brazil's president. But if you're Mexican or Mexican-American and you want to say anything about Calderon at the United Nations and the significance of that, do you even pay attention? Do you even care? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call right up. You'll get right on. Ken Ellingwood, is this a big deal in Mexico? I think most countries of the world have a different relationship with the United Nations than the United States does. Americans are, in general, fairly cynical about the UN and don't think that much can get accomplished there, even though I think Americans tend to hold it in fairly high regard. But, you know, as a place where not all that much happens, but a lot of words. What about in Mexico?
Well, the American president has a bully pulpit by virtue of being the American president. The Mexican president doesn't have a bully pulpit, doesn't have a way of sending a message to the world. Has plenty of ways to send messages to the United States. But I think what Calderon's trying to do here, in addition to making some other points in that speech about his administration and what it has done, he's appealing for help. His country is going through a terrible time. On the day he made that speech in New York, if he had been at home in Mexico, he would have seen the headlines having to do with the dumping of 35 bodies on a street in the city of Veracruz. This kind of violence, as horrible as it is, has become pretty routine here. And Mexicans are appalled, they're frightened, they're confused about what's happening in their country, and there's really no political consensus on how to deal with it. Calderon has stubbornly pushed ahead with his anti-crime strategy, which relies very heavily on the military, and he's been criticized for that.
So we have a full board of Mexican New Yorkers calling in to react to this speech. Let's hear from a few of you. Felix in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Felix. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, guys.
So what do you think?
Well, what I think is that he was right at that time. People are consuming a lot of drugs here, and not even, I'm not going to say in a rich or poor neighborhood, let's say middle class, and all you see here is people consuming more drugs more than 10 years ago. You understand?
Yes.
Because I live, I work, I got kids, I got a wife, and I see people making businesses and drugs, and I could see that nobody does nothing about it. These people have been selling drugs for years, and there's like nothing happening here.
So what do you think? The U.S. blames Mexico, Mexico blames the U.S., and they need to work better together?
They have to stick together. You understand? They have to stick together. If they put pressure on this country, and then they put pressure on the other countries, I think things are going to get better. But if you guys don't get together, you know, USA and Mexico, and not only these two countries, we're talking about Guatemala, Salvador, all those places. The whole route is full of drugs.
Felix, thank you so much. Call us again, okay?
Bye-bye.
Call us on other things, too. Jose, is it? I'm sorry. Is it Jose? That name said Jose, and now it doesn't say Jose.
Hello?
On my screen. Hi. Forgive me. What's your name?
Jose, yes.
Jose, thanks for calling. So yeah, what do you think when you hear that?
Well, what I was telling the screener is that I'm usually opposed to President Calderon's positions on the militarization of the war on drugs and economic policy. But I thought I heard his whole speech, and I think it was very courageous and very wide-ranging and very deep in terms of many, many issues, climate change, and in particular the emphasis on the financials of the drug cartels and the combat of arms. Or the control of arms across the border.
Right, a lot of weapons get shipped from the United States, smuggled into Mexico, even as the drugs are getting smuggled across the border in this direction. Jose, what is it that you usually are opposed to with respect to President Calderon? You said you usually don't like his policies.
Yeah, well, I don't agree. Well, first of the way he was elected, since from that point on, his combat on poverty, I think, is like very dogmatic, and the way he has reacted to U.S. pressure on the war of drugs is by militarizing the country, and so the death, like the 50,000 dead, come from both sides, and that's why also the Mexican society is being organized, is getting organized right now, like civil society with the families, victims, to demand from President Calderon a little change or a lot of change.
John, thank you. Jose, thank you very much. I appreciate you chiming in. Call us again. Let's slip one more in here real quickly because our time for this segment is running out before we go on to two more country speech excerpts. Terry, calling from Indiana. Terry, thanks so much.
Yes, hello. I do agree what the president of Mexico said about the issue with drugs, that the if we take where is the root or where is the problem, the problem is here in the U.S. There is a huge market of drugs. As we know, the U.S. sent guns and everything to Mexico, and I think that the President Calderon is facing a huge problem in his term, just because he's the one that has the courage to confront the dealers. And before it was kind of an unwritten kind of agreement between the drug dealers and the governments, both Mexico and the U.S., in terms of keeping things under control. But since the President of Mexico has taken charge of it, obviously there is a lot of issues and problems, as we know. But I do agree what the President said, that the problem is he has a market, and the market is mainly the U.S.
Terry, thank you so much. So, well, everybody's pretty much agreeing. Who's calling in? Ken Ellingwood, Mexico Bureau correspondent for the L.A. Times. So this speech, to whatever degree it was paid attention to by Mexicans in this country, at least, seems to have struck a chord. Would the U.N. itself have a role in combating the drug trade and violence? Are we talking peacekeepers along the border, even as the U.S. wants to keep illegal immigrants out? Or is there a U.N. role to play?
Probably not. There have been at times suggestions that the Blue Helmets, the UN peacekeepers, come to the most violent cities in Mexico along the border, but those have been pretty quickly dismissed. Mexico is very sensitive about its sovereignty and is highly unlikely to allow any kind of foreign or international force play a direct boots-on-the-ground role here. I think what Calderon wants to do here is a plea for help and also justify, you'll note the other part that he said, is we're doing our part. For a long time, Mexico was accused, as the last caller noted, of turning a blind eye to the corruption, to the collusion with drug cartels, and to the drug trade. And now he's trying to say, look, we are doing something now. Help us out. The other element that wasn't aired of his speech that has to do with the United States is the traffic of weapons. And that's the other refrain that we've heard a lot, is the flow of weapons south from the United States into Mexico that are arming these drug cartels.
Our good old lax gun laws in the United States. Mayor Bloomberg complains about how illegal guns wind up here involved in crime, and I guess President Calderon complains about how they wind up down there involved in crime, organized crime in the drug trade. Ken Ellingwood, correspondent in the Mexico Bureau for the LA Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In a minute, we continue our survey of UN speeches not given by Barack Obama yesterday. We will hear a couple of minutes of President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria. His country, in fact, its UN offices, were recently rocked by a suicide bombing. We'll talk a little bit about terrorism in Nigeria and how it relates potentially to terrorism here. And then you think our knuckles were being rapped by President Calderon. Wait till you hear what the new president of Brazil, by the way, the first woman head of state ever to open a General Assembly session. Wait till you hear what the president of Brazil is saying about political gridlock in the United States. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening. We always appreciate you lending us your ears. Ron Suskind later in the program with his book about President Obama and Wall Street. This book is already making news, and the LA Times says no book has unnerved the White House as much as this one. So Ron Suskind, who did a lot of investigative reporting on the Bush administration that they didn't like, now turning his journalist's eye on the Obama administration coming up later this morning. But right now, we continue our survey of UN speeches not given by President Obama yesterday, and we continue with President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria. That is his name, for those of you who don't know that. His country was recently rocked by a suicide bombing at the UN offices in Abuja, and he addressed the bombing and the rise of terrorism, and then went on to talk about last April's elections. Here is Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, a couple of minutes of his speech at the United Nations yesterday.
Over the past few months, we in Nigeria have faced an upsurge of terrorist attack in parts of our country. Only recently, the United Nations building in Abuja, housing several UN agencies, was the target of an atrocious terrorist attack which left several dead. On behalf of the government and people of Nigeria, I'd like to convey my sincere condolences to the families of the victims and to the entire UN family for this barbaric and heinous attack against those who have dedicated their lives to helping others. As the United States and the rest of the world commemorate the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we are reminded of the international dimension of terrorism and imperative of a concerted global response to combat this scourge. Mr. President, for us in Nigeria, terrorist acts, rather than intimidate, would only help to strengthen our resolve to develop appropriate national strategies and collaborate even more closely with the international community in the fight against this menace. When I stood before this assembly last year, I gave a solemn pledge that Nigeria will conduct free and credible elections in the second quarter of the year. I am glad to report that we indeed conducted what have been adjudged credible and transparent general elections in April. Let me take this opportunity to thank the United Nations and all other organizations and nations and individuals that assisted us to achieve that feat. The elections are now behind us, and the government which I head is well on course to implement our programs of transformation, a strategic plan for the delivery of the dividends of democracy to citizens, and for preparing our country for the challenges of the future.
2 minutes of the President of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, speaking at the UN General Assembly yesterday. Joining us now for a few minutes on this is John Gambrell, Chief Correspondent in Lagos, the capital of Nigeria, for the Associated Press. John, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. Thank you. And any Nigerians want to call in? Just 5 minutes. Anything you want to say about your president speaking at the United Nations yesterday and what you think is important about it for Nigeria or for the United States, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Call right up. You'll get right on. And, John, I noticed that in the speech, the president didn't specifically mention al-Qaeda in connection with this terrorist bombing of a U.N. office in Nigeria, but he indicated that terrorism in Nigeria is linked to terrorism elsewhere. Is he putting the events there in a global context?
I think the government has been forced to try to do that since the U.N. bombing. In general, Nigeria, which is split largely between a Muslim north and a Christian south, they've been trying to avoid actually saying that terrorism actually happens in this country. There was a lot of outroar by lawmakers when the Abdul Muttalib attempted bombing happened over Detroit in Christmas 2009. The government's been very sensitive to allegations of terrorism. But now I think with the bombing of the UN house in Abuja, they have no choice but to acknowledge the fact that Boko Haram, this radical sect that operates in the Northeast, has gotten far out of control beyond which what the security agencies can handle in this country.
The country is split, as are many North African nations, between mostly Muslims in the north and mostly Christians and others in the south, more the sub-Saharan Africa part. How big of a rift is this within the country, and is that the root of the bombing?
It's interesting. Like in Lagos, which is the biggest city in Nigeria in the south, Muslims and Christians live next door to each other. They intermarry. There's no trouble. But what happens is when you get into communities where there's actually divisions based on either political or economic gains, you see periodic ethnic and religious violence, like in Jos, which is in the center part of the country, or in Kaduna, which saw hundreds die after the April elections this year. But really what it comes down to is economics and political power most of the time. Boko Haram itself, this new rise of radicalism in the country, seems to have a much more international flair, picking foreigners, foreign targets now, something that Nigerians can't sweep under the rug anymore. The ethnic and religious localized violence that's always been kind of quiet and no one ever really talks about, but now they're being forced to confront this force that's in the country.
So why was the UN a target? What would that represent to the terrorists?
The Boko Haram, which wants strict implementation of Sharia law across Nigeria, later said that they viewed the UN as a legitimate target because it has Western ideals and was operating under sort of a Western mandate. The reasons why they were actually targeted remained very murky, but it seems as though there's an idea that any sort of Western influence is a decaying factor, and many blame the U.S. and Western powers for the degradation of the country over its 50 years of independence because of the fact that Nigeria, which is a major crude oil supplier, is one of the top energy suppliers to the U.S., with billions of dollars flowing into the government without any recognizable state aid, no roads, no hospitals, no nothing. Especially in the north, people look for some sort of political force or ideal to cling to, and many have started to embrace radicalism.
Sonny in Queens, you're on WNYC. Sonny, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you, Brian. Brian, I'm a Nigerian. I live in New York now for the past 22 years. I agree with what the president is saying, but I think the president is being overly apprehensive in trying to do some certain things like combating the terrorism. He's trying so hard not to offend, like the Muslims by attacking them furiously the way it should be attacked.
You mean militarily? You mean militarily attacked?
No, using the police. Using the police.
Yes.
And the police department is very, very corrupt. I think it should start from trying to get all the bad apples. You know, you could see police officers taking bribes from the motorists on the road openly. You know, I think you need to reform the police department because with the police being so corrupt, there is nothing can be achieved. You know, in the country. I think that should be the first thing he can, because if you don't reform the police department, the terrorists don't only gonna give bribes to the police, and that's gonna be about it. So the president needs to be more aggressive. He's just trying so hard not to offend the Muslim group.
Sonny, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Please call us again on other things as well. John Gambrell, chief correspondent for the AP in Lagos. And by the way, I apologize. I mistakenly said that Lagos is the capital of Nigeria. It's actually Abuja, where this bombing took place. That's the capital of Nigeria, right? Right, John?
That's correct, sir.
So is that a commonly held feeling among Nigerians that the president is being too timid in his response to the terrorism?
It is. And when he was actually elected, a lot of international observers said the April elections were credible, but they weren't entirely legitimate. There was voting irregularities in the Muslim North and the Christian South. And a lot of people felt that Jonathan, who came to power only after the elected Muslim leader of the country died, that he should have stepped aside and allowed another Muslim to come in to the presidency under the ruling party. The fact that Jonathan contested kind of created this giant rift in the country. Well, not a giant rift, but an emotional rift in the country. And the country still has a lot of scars from about 45 years of military dictatorships that ruled the country after independence in 1960. I mean, most of those military dictators, the majority, were from the Muslim North and part of the House of Fulani ethnic group. So there's a lot of that tension that still remains. People in the South believe that they should have the power now, and they believe that Jonathan is the vehicle to have that power. But at the same time, as the caller said, I think Jonathan is boxed in and unwilling to commit himself to something that may enrage a whole half of the country.
Before you go, was this very emotional, do you think, yesterday? I realize you're there, not here. But the president speaking at the United Nations about this terrorism in Nigeria, since it was the UN offices that were bombed?
I think that if you talk to the UN employees here, I mean, it's decimated that staff. I mean, they're emotionally unable to work. I know that a lot of their operations are still in disarray. But for the average Nigerian, I think they're looking to see what Jonathan is actually going to do. He has made a lot of comments. There's been a lot of statements that have come out of his office, but there's been no clear police or military or intelligence action to try to combat this terrorist group.
John Gambrell, chief correspondent for the AP in Lagos, Nigeria. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And our survey of UN speeches not given by President Obama yesterday and not about a Palestinian state concludes now as we move to Brazil and President Dilma Rousseff. She spoke first yesterday, the first woman to open the UN General Assembly ever. Here's what she had to say about that historic moment.
It is with a sense of personal humbleness, but with the justified pride of a woman, that I experience this historic moment. I share this emotion with more than half of the human beings on this planet, who, like me, were born women, and who, with a sense of purposeful determination, currently take the place they righteously deserve in the world. I'm quite certain, ladies and gentlemen, that this will be the century of women.
President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil speaking through a Portuguese to English translator, also, I guess, a female to male translator. Why they couldn't give her a woman translator, I don't know. But she went on to speak about Brazil's role in the global economy. Remember, Brazil is one of what they call the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, on the rise economically as the U.S. and Europe sink right now. And here's about 2 minutes of her talking about economic policy in Europe, the U.S. and developing countries, and political gridlock in the United States.
We want and we can help those countries where the crisis is already very acute while there is enough time. A new type of cooperation between emerging countries and developed countries is a historic opportunity for us to reshape and redefine on the basis of solidarity and responsibility the commitments that should govern international relations. The world of today faces an economic governance and political coordination crisis. Confidence and growth will not be resumed for as long as coordination efforts between United Nations member countries and other multilateral institutions such as G20, the IMF, the World Bank, and other organizations are not fully expanded. The United Nations and such organizations urgently need to send out clear signals of political cohesion and macroeconomic coordination.
The President of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, speaking obviously through a translator, the first head of state to speak at the UN General Assembly this year. And with us briefly is Brian Winter, chief correspondent in Brazil for Reuters. Brian, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Brian.
It sounded to me a bit like President Rousseff was scolding the United States and Europe a bit. Get your act together or we're all going down with you. Is that how this speech is being reported on in Brazil?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there, as you've pointed out, it's been a good couple of years here in Brazil. The economy's been growing. It was one of the last countries to go into the recession a couple of years ago, one of the first to come out. The economy grew 7.5% last year. Things have been great, but the government here is just frankly terrified that the problems in the quote-unquote rich world are going to end up bringing Brazil down again, and they obviously, they're concerned about lifting a couple more million people out of poverty before that happens.
How much does Brazil see itself now as one of the major global economic forces? Do they use this term BRIC there in the media a lot? And does that lead to the president of Brazil strutting her stuff more than somebody from this country might have in the past?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they're very conscious of the fact down here that the world is changing. And the finance ministry even issued a somewhat unusual statement yesterday saying that, you know, the crises in the rich world at the moment should lead to the ascendancy on the global scale of not only Brazil, but of its BRICS partners, Russia, India, China. And they've also added South Africa to that group. To make it plural, I guess.
Right. At BRICS?
Yeah, that's right.
We just have a couple of minutes for calls. I think we lingered too long in Mexico at the beginning of this segment, to tell you the truth, and we're going to run out of time. But if you are Brazilian or Brazilian American, call right up, and you'll get right on, a couple of you anyway, and tell us how, as a Brazilian American, you see the U.S. economy and the U.S. response to our economic problems. Don't call to talk about Brazil today. Call to talk about the U.S. as seen by you as a Brazilian American. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Just for a few minutes, call right up, you'll get right on. And Brian Winter from Reuters in Brazil, she took a shot at U.S. political gridlock, too.
Yeah, well, you know, I have very good contacts within her government, and I've been told that she was actually starting every day during July and August reading international newspapers and was particularly interested in the Tea Party and was quite upset about what was going on with the confrontation over the debt ceiling during that time because she, you know, saw it as a unnecessary confrontation that could eventually have consequences that would spill over into Brazil.
So does that spill over in Brazil, what the Tea Party does in Iowa, matters in Sao Paulo?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a hugely direct effect, but in that it, to the extent that it makes the global economic situation worse, it's also worth pointing out that Brazil is actually, believe it or not, now the fourth biggest holder of U.S. Treasury bonds. I mean, I know that as Americans we hear about the Chinese all the time, but Brazil is actually quite high up on the list with something on the order of, I think it's about $250 billion worth of U.S. Treasuries. So, you know, they're a stakeholder in that sense as well.
And Brazil earlier this month moved to spearhead an effort by the BRICS group, or I guess if it's South Africa, maybe it's BRICSA, to support the crisis hit Eurozone by making coordinated purchases of Eurozone government bonds. So this is what it's come to, Brazil bailing out Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Although, you know, to be fair, there is another side to this. Some people are worried here that Brazil might be a little too eager to go around the world and seem as this glorious benefactor when it is certainly vulnerable on its own territory. And there was even a comment today from the World Bank President Robert Zoellick essentially saying that the best thing that the BRICS countries can do at this point is take care of their own domestic situations and make sure that they're okay.
Will in Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Will.
How are you today? Yeah, I think the greatest difference right now is that America has been investing in the corporations again. And Brazil, as you mentioned before, was investing in the poor. So once you get the people working, they can invest into the economy, and that's what's missing in America at this moment.
Thank you very much. Edson in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you thinking?
Oh, I think the speech was good. The main thing is that in the past 4 or 5 years, Brazil grew very, very much, over 7%. However, when we talk about growing, it's just for the big business, you know, and Brazil is part of a BRICS now. It's trying to convince the world that Brazil needs to be part of the council, the Security Council in the UN. However, Brazil has serious problems with infrastructure in Brazil. Also, there is inequality. It's huge inequality in Brazil. I don't know if people know, but half of the Brazilian population is from Afro descent. And they are, most of them, the majority of them is enfranchised. So there's this perception that Brazil is growing, but the inequality in Brazil is still huge.
I'm glad you brought that up. And this is about Brazil and not about Brazilian perception of the United States. But let's end on this note, Brian. The growth of the Brazilian economy. I mean, it's true that when we used to talk about Brazil in the U.S. media, economically, we would talk about the unbelievable disparities between rich and poor there, much, much more than here, and our disparities are pretty bad. But now we talk about the growth. Has the growth done much at all to even out the disparities between rich and poor?
Yes. I mean, that's a big part of the Brazilian story, is that they've managed to engineer it in a way where, for the most part, it's the people at the bottom of the social pyramid that have benefited most from this period of growth.
How?
By basically taking measures that will stimulate credit for those groups of people who, you know, never had any access to credit for years and years, and that was in part because of a long tradition of fiscal mismanagement. I mean, again, you say how perceptions have changed. Brazil, 17 years ago, had inflation of 2,500% in 1 year. And so, you know, things have changed pretty quickly. And that stability is also the other big factor. Inflation damages poor the most, and by getting inflation down into the single digits, they've made it possible for everybody across the economy to, you know, do basic things like invest and plan for the future.
Brian Winter, chief correspondent in Brazil for Reuters. Thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes our brief survey of speeches other than by President Obama at the UN yesterday. We listened to excerpts from the presidents of Brazil, Mexico, and Nigeria. And we're opening a comments page on our website now for anybody else from any other country whose head of states actually spoke yesterday to comment there. And for everybody else, it's going to be a really interesting comments page, I hope, to go and read. The other countries that were represented at the podium yesterday: Qatar, Kazakhstan, France, Argentina, Lebanon, North Korea, Equatorial Guinea, Jordan, Finland, Colombia, Estonia, Switzerland, Honduras, Ukraine, Paraguay, Rwanda, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Guyana, Mongolia, South Africa, Latvia, Guatemala, Senegal, Mozambique, Afghanistan, Bolivia, Slovenia, and the Republic of Chad. So anybody from any of those countries, or anyone named Chad, can go to our website right now if you actually paid attention to the speech of your head of state or representative, and write down what was important about it and what you'd like other Americans reading our website to know. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And coming up next, our own education reporter Beth Fertig, as we continue to roll out the brand new WNYC collaboration with the New York Times called schoolbook.org. Today, how school reform trickles down or not to the classroom. Stay tuned.